ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
I hope and pray I will still be able to stay on the NDIS because at the end of the day, autistic people are getting targeted.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
This podcast uses the name and voice of an Aboriginal person who's died and includes references to suicide.
Kirsty, hello again.
Hi, Erin.
So up to the final episode of Tammy's story, which is the series that you've been reporting for Background Briefing. And last time we spoke, you told me how Tammy ended up in prison in the first place.
So months ago, you came to station wanting to be mocked up.
Yep.
Or do you want to get out of jail?
Yeah, it'd be nice. I went into like a small psychosis and I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe. So I went to Woolworths to get charged.
Okay.
So I could come here and be safe.
I'm going to put you on a CRO, conditional release order, for 12 months, okay?
Thank you, Your Honour.
As far as I'm concerned, that should mean you'll be released.
Tammy was never released. She died alone in her cell from drinking too much water, without prison staff understanding what was going on. Tammy's family wants the police and the health system and the prisons to learn lessons from her death.
I'll never have the opportunity to share pivotal moments with her, be it moving overseas to pursue my dreams and goals, see me fall in love, or walking me down the aisle on my wedding day.
It's just obviously such a sad situation all around for the family. So, Kirsty, what else is there to this story?
Well, Erin, there's more. Tammy's story doesn't end there. So 9 months ago, I got a ping in my inbox, an email about an inmate who died in unusual circumstances.
Okay.
They landed in prison after they'd self-represented in court and said they didn't want bail. It turns out they had schizophrenia. In prison, their mental health got worse. The email described how the person was placed in a solitary observation cell under 24-hour CCTV surveillance, where they then started drinking multiple cups of water.
Yeah.
And when they collapsed, no one noticed or went in straight away.
Wow. Wait, is this Tammy that we're talking about?
No, it's not Tammy.
It's another person.
Yeah, this is Daniel Turnbull's story.
Wow, that is just almost eerie, the similarities with Tammy's case.
It really is. He was only 35 years old and he died the same way that Tammy did, from polydipsia, drinking too much water, in the same prison system, in the same state, just 2 months before Tammy.
Just 2 months before Tammy died.
Yeah. And the person that contacted me is a woman called Rebecca Ferreira.
Danny is my half-brother. And he was born when I was 13. It was a very close relationship that I had with Danny.
Danny had a difficult childhood, but Rebecca remembers him as a warm and affectionate kid.
He loved the sea. Even as a baby, right through to when he was a boy, he'd stop and say, "Oh, look at that bird," or, "Oh, the ocean looks beautiful," or, "Oh, it's so sunny today." He was always his happiest when we were out.
And that makes it all the more tragic for Rebecca, that her brother, like Tammy, spent the final days of his life alone in a cell. On his last day, he drank around 240 cups of water over 9 hours. That's more than 40 litres.
Wow.
And no one noticed.
Mm.
And when he collapsed, it took 44 minutes before anyone entered his cell.
I've seen the stills of Danny in the moments he collapsed and then was unresponsive on the floor. It was an extended amount of time. When I see that, the devastation is that that's my brother and he needs help and he's not being helped.
Hey,
So, Kirsty, why didn't that happen? Like, why didn't anyone step in? Is it a bit like in Tammy's case where the guards weren't doing the checks that they were meant to?
Yeah, it's kind of similar. And at the coronial inquest into Danny's death, the guard said they just didn't know to look out for polydipsia. An expert told the coroner it's a condition that's hard to spot. And the coroner who investigated Danny's death accepted this, and she found he received adequate care for his mental health condition.
Hmm.
But that's not what it looks like to Rebecca.
A huge amount of finger pointing, a huge amount of it's not my fault, I didn't know. All coming back to this apex of we didn't know about water intake.
So that's two prisoners that have died from drinking too much water when they're meant to be under 24-hour watch. And both times the guards say they didn't know about the risks of polydipsia.
How come?
Well, that's a good question. Because it also happened to another prisoner a year and 9 months before Tammy died.
This is a third death in custody from drinking too much water.
That's right.
Gosh. So what do we know about this third person?
So his name is Trevor Samuel.
Mm-hmm.
He's a 35-year-old Waramaya Eniyama man. And in this case, the prison staff knew about his polydipsia and they tried to manage it.
Mm-hmm.
They monitored his water intake. They gave him weekly blood tests to check his sodium levels. And if he was showing signs of water intoxication, they turned off the water to his cell. Despite all of that, he was still able to drink enough water to kill him.
Wow. And so was his death investigated as well?
Yeah, it was. And that investigation was also finished before Tammy and Daniel died.
So it was actually on the radar of the authorities that there were weaknesses in the system and that this was a potentially deadly condition.
That's right. And when Rebecca sent me that email telling me about her brother, she didn't know anything about Trevor's case. And when I told her, she was angry.
There were no learnings from that at all. That's appalling.
Because if something had been done about it, she believes that could have helped her brother or Tammy.
It's not the great mystery they deemed it to be when Danny passed.
Corrective Services New South Wales, which runs the state's prisons, and Justice Health, which provides prison healthcare, have now updated their policies so that guards have to alert a health worker if an inmate is drinking an excessive amount of water.
Okay.
They did so after these deaths. Before I got that email from Rebecca, I'd been investigating Aboriginal deaths in custody with my colleague Joanna McCarthy. We'd been trying to get our hands on coronial records to see if there were any common themes showing up when people died in prison. We ended up finding these volunteer law students at the University of Queensland who've been individually downloading coronial documents from around the country and putting them into one searchable database. So we got all those files and then built our own database. And then we got an AI program to search it, looking for patterns. And so we're really using AI as a bit of a sorting tool. We knew it would get things wrong, but it gave us a pointer on which of these cases we needed to look at. And then we read and fact-checked each one.
Yeah.
And that's how we found out about Tammy and Trevor.
So the AI search picked up on the polydipsia cases.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha.
So we went and read those cases, and that's why we knew about Trevor and Tammy, who were both Aboriginal, but we hadn't come across Danny yet, who isn't.
Yeah, okay.
Once we knew about all three cases, we decided to try a broader search. We asked the AI program to identify every case in New South Wales over the past decade where the person who died had schizophrenia, Indigenous and non-Indigenous.
Okay.
And that's when we started to see other cases that reminded us of Tammy's.
In what way?
Well, they all involved people with schizophrenia. And to give you an example, we found the case of a man known as MH. He died by suicide while he was on a wait list to see a psychiatrist in Goulburn Prison.
Wow, okay.
We found the case of Jonathan Hogan, a Wiradjuri, Ngiyampaa and Murawari man. He had schizophrenia and was experiencing psychosis when he went into prison. He got no treatment for 3 weeks. He had multiple psychiatric reviews cancelled and he was put in a cell with known hanging points where he died.
Oh, gosh, that's terrible.
We found the case of Junior Finica, whose mental health got much worse after he was put in a safe cell with limited human contact, and who might have survived had the guards responded to his knock-up calls. And we found the case of Simon Cartwright, who died a year before Tammy. Like Tammy, he was in a CCTV observation cell. He had schizophrenia and he couldn't get a mental health bed. He went hours without being physically checked, and he died of septicemia, a treatable condition.
And Kirsty, were all of these cases investigated by a coroner?
Yeah, they were. And some of the findings were very scathing. In one case, the coroner even said New South Wales Corrective Services should not be placed in a position to care for people with severe mental illness.
Wow. And the cases that you've mentioned there, when did they happen? Like, were they before or after Tammy's death?
In all of these cases except one, the findings were handed down before Tammy died.
Okay.
All up, we found 19 inquests over the last decade, which identified deficiencies in the care or supervision of people with schizophrenia. And when we expanded that to look at any other mental illness, the number jumped to 39. And in a third of those inquests, the person who died was Indigenous. Among them, Tammy and Trevor.
Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander communities have been engaged in hundreds of inquests nationwide, and they all surround the same issues. Things like harsh and punitive bail laws, things like inappropriate prison healthcare, things like poor policing practices.
Nerita Waite is a Yorta Yorta and Ngurrindjeri woman who leads the peak body for Aboriginal Legal Services, which represented Tammy's family at the inquest.
There are many Tammies that are fronting courts across Australia day in, day out.
It just seems quite shocking that with all of these years, decades of debate around especially Indigenous deaths in custody and all the focus on closing the gap when it comes to these preventable deaths, the issues are so well documented and yet there's not been the system change to stop it happening again.
Yeah, and we had the 1991 Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody that recommended prisoners receive health care that's equivalent to the community standards. In many of these cases, the coroner found this standard wasn't met.
If you speak to any Aboriginal family who has gone through the coronial process, they will tell you that it didn't lead to them feeling a sense of justice because inevitably no one is really held responsible. There is no accountability. There is no guarantee that recommendations will be enacted and that deaths will be prevented in future. We know that prisons are not a suitable place to treat mental health issues, to treat disability. But yet, when you look at the data, the vast amount of people sitting in prisons have either a disability or a mental health condition, or they have both.
And that's what we found so striking. When we were going through our database, reading inquest after inquest, the same issues came up and similar findings being made by coroners in New South Wales. And over the course of 10 years, the same mistakes were made over and over again.
Wow.
In our database, you hear all these echoes of Tammy's story.
Yeah.
And one of those stories is Bailey McKendar, a 20-year-old Wiradjuri man who had anxiety and panic disorder. Like Tammy, he wasn't seen by a mental health team when he urgently needed it. He was placed in the care of a risk intervention team in prison, known as a RIT team. You might remember that from the first episode. The RIT team put him in an assessment cell because he was at risk of self-harm. He hated it. He couldn't even leave for exercise. He had panic attacks, but they were ignored. And when he screamed in distress, the guards told him if he didn't stop, he'd be in there much longer. Like Tammy, his mother called to try and speak to staff about Bailey's condition, and her calls didn't get through. Finally, Bailey was so desperate not to go back to the observation cell after a hospital visit that he escaped, ran to a nearby wall, and fell 8 metres to his death. the coroner, Elaine Truscott, was scathing about what happened to Bailey. She cried as she handed down her findings. We've had her words revoiced by an actor.
Something has to change. These findings and recommendations will not stop the court sending young Baileys to prison. They will not cause the correctional system to cater for all kinds in better and more ways. And I suspect they will not even result in better mental health and psychological support in prisons, which are full of people who need it. But perhaps they will save one or two from being placed in writ cells to battle their own demons alone.
Wow.
The coroner made a series of recommendations, a few of which looked really relevant to Tammy's case. She said that writ teams should include, or at least have access to, a psychologist. That a support person should be able to join review meetings remotely to advocate for the inmate and give them the help that they need. That writ teams should have to name in writing which correctional officer will be responsible for managing the inmate on each shift. And that the guard should have to document hourly any changes in behaviour or health of the person they're monitoring. After Bailey's inquest, Corrections did its own review of the processes used by writ teams, but we don't know what came out of it. A spokesperson told us Corrections welcomes and carefully considers each recommendation made by a coroner. But these recommendations came to nothing, because Corrections New South Wales rejected them. I couldn't speak to the coroner in Tammy's or Bailey's case, but I could speak to someone who's been in their place, who used to sit in that chair in the New South Wales Coroner's Court. His name is Hugh Dillon. He's a veteran coroner and an advocate for prison reform. Now that he's left the court, he can speak more freely about the hurdles he faced navigating the coronial system.
It's under-resourced. That's the main thing. It's really struggling to do the kind of work it should be doing, and in particular, doing the kind of work it should be doing to prevent or help prevent future deaths.
And he doesn't hold back.
There is no capacity for the state coroner to follow up recommendations or to demand answers or response from government departments or ministers. If you don't follow it up, it's almost pointless. It's just a performance.
Mm. So the coroner is a toothless tiger in the sense that it can recommend whatever it wants, but it doesn't necessarily effect change.
Yeah, in a sense. And in Bailey's case, the coroner handed down those recommendations and Corrections New South Wales simply rejected them. And this isn't an uncommon scenario. In about a quarter of the 39 cases we found, Corrections didn't support the recommendations in full. Sometimes because they're not feasible, sometimes because they already have policies in place, or simply not enough resources. There's no obligation for the implementation of these recommendations. And even if they were implemented, the system is exhausted. Right now, the number of people in New South Wales prisons is the highest on record.
I think corrective services, I think Justice Health, they're trying hard. What they do have is an influx of more and more people coming into the system.
And a growing number of them have a history of mental illness. And he's not quite sure
what we can expect if we keep asking the system to get better, if we keep putting more people with serious mental illness into prisons rather than into hospitals or under much more comprehensive community care, but we don't give it the resources it needs to do better. So there's no simple solution to any of this. And, you know, governments I know have all sorts of priorities, and this is, I hope, one of them, but I think it's quite low down the list of their priorities, and I wish it were higher.
The New South Wales government told me it's appointed two extra coroners to help with the workload, and that it's considering recommendations from a review into the Coroner's Act. Caught up in all this are the inmates, but also prison staff, guards, doctors, and nurses who are left staring at the problem.
You're making decisions about people's lives and you're so under pressure and you're so rushed. So the balance between meeting that needs of the patient and being able to provide the care to everyone is a level of stress that's, it's a heavy weight.
I'm meeting up with Jade Coupland, the prison nurse, and you might remember her from episode one. She's speaking to us as a union member.
Okay.
I just love supporting people. I think you see people at the worst moments of their life, and I love being there for them, being a little bit of positive.
She's been helping me understand what it's like behind the razor wire fences of New South Wales prisons.
An average day you come in the morning you get handover from the night shift staff. You'll be responsible for an area and that would look like anywhere between 100 to 300 patients you're caring for.
And then the conversation turns.
You're standing with this patient in front of you. You have no idea what's happened to them.
Jade is talking about what it was like to see one of her patients die in custody.
And it might only be you and one other nurse. It might even only be you.
She doesn't go into much detail because it's a tough memory for her to revisit.
Especially the first time attending one was probably one of the hardest things to digest. It's not something that hits you straight away. It might be weeks, months, years later when it hits you that that happened. I'm not even sure I've ever had the opportunity to fully process the situation that occurred.
It's an experience she shares with many of her colleagues.
It's very frightening. It's not like a hospital. We're not stacked with resources. We're not armed with doctors.
And the trauma doesn't end there, because those nurses also need to face the coroner's court.
You would never, as a nurse, do anything that you know would lead to a patient's death. So the fact that you're already there is awful. But to then be placed on a stand and criticised for failures of a system that you have no control over. You know, these nurses aren't withholding care. They're unable to provide care because they're short-staffed. So it's just the worst thing you can experience to potentially have someone looking to blame you for a failure of the system.
And Erin, I asked Justice Health about this. They said they are trying to improve things. In recent years, they've introduced new training for nurses and guards, real-time sharing of health records, a telehealth psychiatric service, and suicide prevention teams. Jade says that's had a positive impact, but it's not enough. She chose nursing as a career to help people when they're at their most vulnerable. But she's decided to leave her job at Silverwater Prison.
It's not the patients, it's not the job itself, it's the system. You can't change the system and it's draining to work inside of it.
She's back at uni studying to be a lawyer, to help people before they get into prison.
We do care and we do try our best and like we grieve their loved ones too and we hate the system that's put them there too.
I'm with my producer, Joe McCarthy, pacing up and down one of those narrow Sydney laneways in Woolloomooloo. Gritty, looming industrial brick facades encase us on both sides. It's a stark contrast to the high-end city dwellings just streets away. We spot a colourful mural that borders a small door. It's the entrance to our destination, a clinic for the homeless. We're not the only ones waiting to enter. A couple of people are milling around and sitting on the sidewalk, waiting to access the clinic's services. But we're here to catch up with Dr. Olav Nielsen, the psychiatrist who gave expert evidence at Tammy's inquest. Do you remember him?
Yes, I do.
Olav Nielsen.
Oh, I'll take you
up. Great.
A staff member escorts us through the clinic to find Olav.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're guided up this space and through a couple of locked doors. There's people waiting to receive care in a waiting room.
How's the day been today?
We're all short-staffed, hectic. That's usually what happens in places in services like this. We get lack of.
Yeah.
Sal, is Dr... Oh, sorry, you're after Dr. Nielsen.
And it kind of feels like a mini emergency department. You know, there's the sanitizers on the wall, there's nursing equipment.
Great.
Has anyone turned up yet?
No.
I'll put another mouse bit out.
That's all right. Thank you so much.
And we're led into this room that looks like a little ward. There's four hospital beds, white sheets, and after a moment, Olive comes and sits down with us. He's been a psychiatrist and a leading figure in mental health research for more than 20 years. And he's worked in prisons long enough to see how clogged the system is.
There's about 1,000 people with schizophrenia in New South Wales prisons at any one time.
And over time, jails have turned into something else.
I mean, look, prisons are our new asylums. There's no two ways about it. The prisons are by far the biggest mental health service.
And people like Tammy are turning to police for protection.
The police are our frontline mental health workers. There's no escaping it.
But because of how few mental health beds there are available outside of prison,
the police get turned away and the person's not admitted, and of course they're frustrated by that.
He thinks healthcare workers should be the ones responding when people like Tammy are in crisis.
That would be the preferable alternative, that you get a crisis team coming to an acute mental health, and then they call the police if they need to.
Every week at his clinic, Olive sees people with schizophrenia. And every week, without much fuss, he treats them.
The persistent disabling form of schizophrenia, the disability is in decision-making, volition, self-care, and you just need some basic support and prompts and advice to overcome those disabilities. It's not rocket science. It's really pretty basic care.
And it's services like the one we're sitting in, the Matthew Talbot Hostel, that are providing that.
It's a walk-up clinic that really reduces all the barriers to care that you experience in other places, right? So it's at no charge to patients. It's a truly excellent service because it's got, you know, you can get psychiatry. We've always had really committed and excellent GPs. It really is a sort of one-stop shop.
The New South Wales government is putting more money towards mental health services. And some of that is paying for 100 new mental health beds for prisoners. But Olive says without investing more, prisons will continue to be the last holding place for too many people with a mental illness.
And of course, the tragic example is Miss Shipley's, you know, whereby she was acutely unwell, wanted to be admitted to prison for her own safety because of her paranoid beliefs. And then, of course, in prison had this awful complication.
On the final day of the inquest into Tammy's death, I'm back at Vicky's house. It's been more than 3 years since her daughter died, and we're getting ready to go. She's done this routine before. She's been at court for every hearing. And so she grabs her keys, her handbag, and we jump in her car. We're taking the back roads because it's peak hour. It's just before school starts, so it's really busy. But Vicky's driven these roads many times to Lidcombe Coroner's Court. It's been a really long road to this point. It hasn't been easy for her or the family to sit there every day in court and listen to the details of what happened to her daughter. They've seen the footage, they've heard the tapes, they've seen every piece of evidence that was put forward in this case. But Vicky hopes it'll all be worth it.
All the evidence is finished. There's nothing more to hear. And hopefully, when we hear those recommendations, they will be addressing the severe issues that were exposed during the inquest. I'm feeling relieved. I'm just happy that even though it went longer than what we anticipated, it brought out errors that need to be fixed for the future.
Vicky's fought hard for her daughter every day since she's died, telling Tammy's story to help others, keeping the family together in their sadness, and grieving her child.
You feel that guilt because you couldn't be there at the time that you were needed to be there. And then you ask yourself whether you've done enough. When you fought enough, have you done enough? Did you do enough? But you obviously didn't, because you couldn't save them. So you obviously didn't do enough. And you ask yourself that every day. When you're living each day without your daughter, when you know that there could have been a different outcome. Could have been. Should have been a different outcome.
If this story has raised issues for you, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people can also call Crisis Support Service 13 Yarn on 13 92 76. This series is a collaboration with the ABC's Indigenous Affairs team. Background Briefing's sound producers are Lila Schunner and Ingrid Wagner. Sound engineering by Tim Jenkins. Music composition by Russell Stapleton. Fact-checking by Justine Landis-Hanley. Our rollout producer is Ben Svein. The producer for this story is Joanna McCarthy. The supervising producer is Max Chalmers. And the executive producer is Fanu Falali. The reporter on this story is Kirsty Willauer. And I'm Erin Park. To hear more episodes, search for the Background Briefing podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks for listening.